It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In mid-June, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto created a 15-member community task force on police reform to review current police practices and police-community relations. Monday, the task force unveiled its findings and recommendations. Joining us now is the co-chair, former city councilor Valerie McDonald Roberts, and she's also the former director of the city's Bureau of Neighborhood Empowerment. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
The task force was formed within a few weeks of the protests beginning over the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. What did you hear from protests throughout the summer here in Pittsburgh that maybe helped influence your findings and suggestions?
We've had police misconduct throughout the nation, including here in the city of Pittsburgh, forever. The problem is that now with social media, people get to see. And that is the beauty behind social media, is it has taken transparency to a whole new level. So as young people and as the community see this, they are upset with what they see and they reacted accordingly. This was an edict to the city officials, to the county officials, to all of us, to make sure that this does not happen in their neck of the woods.
Your task force had 8 areas of recommendations and findings. Everything from reimagining policing to officer wellness to transparency to use of force. I want to address a couple of them. Racial disparities. Is it more than just looking at the data, comparing the number of black versus white arrests, citations?
The data is just one part of what we have to look at. What we have to look at are anecdotal type of measures. It's not necessarily just data. Implicit bias is a concept that isn't truly data. It exists. It is what's inside of you, who you are, how you think in split decisions. That is not necessarily just data, but implicit bias training was instituted in 2015, first in the public safety department, and then it brought into all departments in the city of Pittsburgh. It absolutely needs to be a continuum of training and of evaluation and review particularly for the officers who deal with the general public.
Reimagining policing, that is one of the categories. In some cities, that could be anything from abolishing the police bureau to reducing funding and redirecting funding from police. What do you mean by reimagining policing in Pittsburgh?
That was a response to the call for defunding, because defunding was misinterpreted. We all understood what many of the protesters meant by defunding. It was basically reallocation. And defunding is a very, I don't want to say divisive, but it's like a fiery word. I don't think anybody feels we don't need public safety and we don't need policing. It's just a matter of how it's administered. For instance, police should not be the social workers. They're not trained to be social workers. So therefore, we have to have funding reallocated to make sure that police are in tandem with the type of resources that help them do the job better.
So other people should be responding to certain calls, not officers or accompanying officers?
It depends. That's something that task force deliberated upon at length. There is no yes, no, black, white answer. As an example, I was on a conference call, and in that conversation, there was a police chief, a real story. Their police force has social workers going to domestic calls. They go together. The two went together. They thought they de-escalated the gentleman who answered the door, who was accused of abusing his wife, and he went back inside. She went out to talk with the social worker. The police officer did not leave her. He stood beside her. Good thing, because the gentleman went back inside, came back out and started shooting. Fortunately, the police officer was in front of the social worker, in front of the wife, and he had a bulletproof vest on. So you just think about that. That's what I'm saying, Kevin. There's no straight answer.
How do you plan to create or rebuild trust with the public Is it as simple as transparency and accountability when it comes to police and public encounters?
Now, I'm going to be frank with you. I think Pittsburgh is very, very much so better off than, unfortunately, many cities who experience serious police misconduct, serious police brutality. And we see that, again, social media helps us to see it in living color, so to speak. It's going to take time. It's going to take implementation of many of the recommendations that are in that task force report.
And can that rebuild the trust?
It's not a matter of can. We don't know what is the future. All we know, Kevin, is what we need to do to try. Our goal is to rebuild the public trust. Please understand, much of the public distrust is because of what has happened nationally. We have not seen many of those scenes in Pittsburgh. But we're not going to put our heads in the sand and say that we're all fine and dandy.
But you have to admit, there have been problems. There have been encounters, whether they were in East Liberty or in other sections of the city, with people peacefully protesting and police encounters that went, shall we say, bad.
Yes. And they went terribly bad. And believe me, I think Chief Schubert admitted that publicly, and everyone knows that. There were mistakes that were made, and there were people that were hurt. And we have to make sure that we rectify that. The biggest way to rectify it is to make sure it never happens again. So the training, the use of rubber bullets and other measures of disbursement, the report recommends that we basically use that as only a last resort measure, that we de-escalate. We have to give latitude and some wiggle room for the mayor and the administration to do their job. And the one thing we do have, Kevin, is their commitment to do that.
Valerie McDonald-Roberts is the co-chair of the Mayor's Community Task Force on Police Reform. Their report can be found on the City of Pittsburgh's website. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coronavirus infections are trending upward across the country, stretching healthcare providers and raising concerns. The hope, a vaccine. But that also takes time. Back with us for a conversation about vaccine trials is Dr. Paul Dupre, the director of the Center for Vaccine Research at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Dupre, welcome back to the show.
It's nice to be back and chat with you again.
So, a trial by AstraZeneca was halted September 8th after a second participant was diagnosed with a neurological condition. A late-stage study by Johnson & Johnson's vaccine paused after there was an illness. How monitored are these people in the trials? And what kind of illness is enough to pause a large-scale trial?
So, to answer the first question, how closely are the individuals monitored? You can imagine, because these trials are in an unusual situation as we find ourselves, really being run under a global microscope. People are really watching. So things which don't ordinarily make news, such as a pause in a clinical trial, which typically the company would not even need to report, make international news. People are monitored incredibly carefully in clinical trials because that's the purpose of them. The purpose of them is to determine whether or not the novel therapeutic, the novel vaccine, is safe. That's the first question that's asked in the phase one trial. So people are monitored incredibly closely. Now, the second question that you asked was, what type of illness? And that's an interesting question. And as far as the Johnson & Johnson trial is concerned, I can't answer it because there's significant patient confidentiality in place. And in this instance, we just don't know what caused that pause. One of the important terms for your listeners to also understand is a hold on a clinical trial. This is not a hold. A hold is something which the company would typically report to their shareholders and also to the general public through the normal channels. That would be if there was a very serious cause for concern. In this instance, we have a pause. And that doesn't mean that a serious event has occurred, but it is not sufficiently serious to hold the clinical trial. So those two things are rather distinct and important to understand as we discuss this.
Should the public be concerned that three trials have been paused?
I actually feel that the public should be confident that even though there's been a lot of discussion about making sure that the vaccines are developed fast, that pauses happen in the normal way. And that's really important for people to understand, because that shows that the normal checks and balances which have been put in place to run those clinical trials are still occurring even in the face of this global pandemic. So actually, what you're seeing is the normal run of the process. It's just we are talking about it. That's really the big difference. Ordinarily, pauses happen all the time in clinical trials, but it's never discussed. It's never international news.
The FDA released additional guidelines for vaccine approval. One such guideline is that drug manufacturers must provide data showing they followed clinical trial participants for a median of 2 months after their final vaccine injections. What does adding that additional layer bring to the vaccine trials?
Again, it just gives us the confidence that the government and the regulatory authorities are really overseeing these studies well. Our confidence in vaccines is so important that integral to the development, the testing, the licensing, and then even after licensing, integral to that is careful attention to detail, rigorous and robust oversight for the good of the people who are going to be vaccinated. Very important, because remember, we can make the vaccines, we can test the vaccines, we can license the vaccines, but it is the individuals, the people who want to be vaccinated, if they don't want to take the vaccines because they are not confident in it, that is a tragedy. So where we are at the moment is we need to talk, inform, communicate well, and ensure that the folks who need the vaccine will have the confidence to take it.
Dr. Paul Dupre is the director of the Center for Vaccine Research at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Dupre, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, and great to chat with you again.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Developing a vaccine is just half the battle when it comes to inoculating the public against the coronavirus. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports you also need a research-grade freezer, a ton of space, and lots of planning.
The coronavirus vaccine probably won't be available to most people until next spring or summer, but there's another virus that everyone should be getting vaccinated against right now. I go to Allegheny Health Network's Waterworks location for my yearly flu shot. The inoculation is stored in a small dorm room-sized fridge next to a row of desks.
We keep our flu vaccines between, like our refrigerators, between 35 and 46 degrees.
The process is unexceptional, though this year everyone wears a mask. Medical assistant Crystal Willis also has on a face shield and a yellow medical gown over her scrubs. Willis taps the syringe to make sure there aren't any air bubbles before giving me the shot.
Okay, You did great.
The flu shot can serve as a sort of dress rehearsal for when a coronavirus vaccine becomes available. With both immunizations, ideally everyone, from the very young to the very old, will get vaccinated in a relatively short amount of time. And like most aspects of life during the pandemic, mass vaccination campaigns are complicated by the need to stay physically apart. Over at UPMC, Manager of Emergency Preparedness Eric Poach says a recent employee flu vaccine clinic accomplished physical distancing by queuing people through a maze of tables.
So there was never anybody beside you. There was never anybody in front of you.
The medical system held another vaccine clinic at an employee parking lot near UPMC Shadyside. Administering inoculations outdoors is safer as open air reduces the risk of transmission.
So we decided to use pop-up tents. Our pharmacy folks were able to bring the medication, store them, take care of them.
But there are huge differences between the flu and coronavirus vaccines. One is that the latter will have to be stored and transported at extremely cold temperatures. For example, Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine needs to be kept at negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 20 degrees colder than the average temperature of the interior of Antarctica.
That's like research grade, freezer cold.
Penn State epidemiologist Matt Ferrari says once vials are removed from these freezers, clinicians have less than a day to inject the inoculations.
And we just don't have any existing supply chain for any product in the United States right now that has that kind of requirement.
He anticipates some doses will get too warm before they're used.
That's something that we don't think about very much in this country right now, right? Is that we have to build in what we call wastage and assume that every dose of vaccine that we take out of the freezer will not necessarily go into somebody.
Another possible hurdle is that a coronavirus vaccine could require a booster shot about 3 to 4 weeks after the first dose is given. Duquesne University epidemiologist David Dossi specializes in public health disaster preparedness.
There's a lot of technology that would have to be in place. Do they sign up on their phone? How do you know when someone's actually received the vaccine? How do you know when someone's missed it?
Last week, states submitted their vaccine distribution plans to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Pennsylvania Department of Health would not share the plan it submitted with WESA. Dossi says, ultimately, the success or failure of the vaccine's distribution lies with state and local health systems.
When people think that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are going to drop down in parachutes and save the day, that's simply not the case.
And in the absence of a cohesive national strategy in response to the pandemic, he says distribution may be slow and fragmented. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.